Well, thank you, Max. I think we've just heard, in part, a libertarian case for the Benedict option. Our third speaker is not a Robert Novak Journalism Fellow, but hope springs eternal, so. Ovik Roy is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He has advised three presidential candidates on policy, including Marco Rubio, Rick Perry, and Mitt Romney. Ovik Roy also serves as senior editor at Forbes, and he is the author of How Medicare Fails the Poor, as well as many other books. Ovik?
I'm very sympathetic to Hayek's critique of conservatism. And my think tank, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, or FREOP for short, is in many ways the Hayek critique institutionalized. We take the position that free markets are the greatest engine of economic equality that has ever been conceived by humanity. And our research is dedicated to deploying free markets to achieve that goal. But today I'm going to offer something different, a conservative critique of the conservative movement. The fundamental problem, as I see it, with the American conservative movement is a desire to return to the American social order of 1955, when the modern American conservative movement was founded. This is not only the subtext of Make America Great Again, but also of the conversation that has taken place at probably literally every Philadelphia Society meeting that has ever been held. It may seem intuitive that conservatives would seek to restore a social order of yesteryear. And the desire of many conservatives to do so reflexively is a big part of why Hayek doesn't consider himself a conservative. But I'm going to argue that the conservative philosophical tradition, what I will call, for the purposes of this discussion, classical conservatism, the conservatism of Aristotle, Burke, Hume, Kirk, and Oakeshott, that conservatism of prudence, custom, and empiricism demands a different response than a nostalgia-fueled restoration of 1955. First, let me make a few factual assertions and then get into the philosophical critique. First, there's a critical flaw in the Frank Meyer fusionist catechism. The fusion of economic liberalism and cultural conservatism that founders of this society took for granted also took for granted that cultural conservatism was then a coherent and unified movement. But cultural conservatism in 1955 was itself a fusion of many different strands. Main Street Americans who simply wanted to support the culture and convention of their neighborhood, their community, evangelical Christians, Roman Catholics, segregationists, WASP elites, opera fans, and even the stray constitutional monarchist. Today, someone who is a temperamental conservative in the sense of upholding mainstream conventional culture, the kind of person who might have read the Saturday Evening Post back in the day, the person who represents that temperament today, who is comfortable with today's mores, who has no problem with gay marriage, for example, popular culture is by definition popular. A song that reaches number one on the charts or a show that tops the ratings gets there because a plurality of people like it. The desire of some on the right to replace conventional culture with something that by definition is less conventional is inherently unconservative and occasionally radical. That doesn't mean we should accept conventional culture. We should strive to improve it, and I'll get into that later. In 1955, a majority of our social and economic elite was politically conservative, by which I mean the wealthy, the CEOs of corporations, the pillars of their communities, which is why Bill Buckley had the impact he had, because he could move fluently in those circles. While that remains true today in certain ways, the wealthy and the influential rarely have children out of wedlock, for example, politically, most of this elite does not think of itself as culturally conservative. The clearest example of this, of course, as we've talked about a lot today, is Silicon Valley, the most entrepreneurial free marketplace in humanity, which is also becoming an echo chamber of cultural leftism. I could go on, but the point I'm making is that when Frank Meyer was publishing In Defense of Freedom in 1962, most cultural conservatives didn't recognize that their own movement was an unnatural and motley coalition that was destined to fall apart within a decade. And cultural conservatism has yet to recover from the failure to understand this, that their internal seven-legged stool has lost four of its legs, and that their agenda has little resonance with the public, especially with rising generations. Two developments accelerated the collapse of the culturally conservative coalition of the 1950s. The first, as Max alluded to, was the FDA approval of the birth control pill in 1960, which fundamentally divorced sex from procreation in ways that are impossible to turn back from. We talk a lot about restoring the family values of the 1950s, but we almost never contend with the way in which sexual mores have permanently changed due to technology. Furthermore, there is actually no correlation between the parts of the country in which, say, illegitimacy is endemic and the parts that vote conservative. There's actually been a really elegant book that's been written about this. It's actually wealthy blue counties in places like Massachusetts and Northern California where illegitimacy is lowest, and it's the red states of the old Confederacy where illegitimacy is highest. And if, by the way, conservative American values are the values of family, personal responsibility, education, and hard work, the most conservative demographic in America is Asians. The divorce rate for non-Hispanic whites in America as of 2015 is 40%. For Asians in America, it's 21%. The teen birth rate for whites is 17%. For Asians, it's 8%. The illegitimacy rate for whites is 29%. For Asians, it's 16%. 36% of white Americans have a college degree. 54% of Asians do. In 2015, median household income for whites was $63,000 a year. For Asians, it was $77,000 a year. And yet, Asians now vote for Democratic presidential candidates at a higher rate than do Hispanics. Why is that? It's because of the second thing that transformed American culture in the 1960s, the civil rights bills of the LBJ era, which formally ended state-sanctioned racial discrimination, opened up immigration from Asia, and ended the Bracero guest worker program with Mexico, which led to a surge in illegal immigration from Latin America. It's also because conservative rhetoric about family values, quote unquote, is often hard to separate from the frequently tribal and intemperate rhetoric of Southern Protestant churches. That is to say, the phrase family values is associated understandably by racial and ethnic minorities as sectarian, even by those ethnic minorities who embrace family values to a greater degree than Southern Protestants do, at least statistically. We talked earlier about black churches. Why is it that black churches are not an ally with religious conservatives and cultural conservatives? It's because many of the Southern churches were places where the Bible was deployed to justify the preservation of segregation, not all, but many, and where it was actually the so-called mainline Protestant churches, Episcopalianism, Presbyterianism, and the black churches, which were the big participants in the civil rights movement. That history still has echoes today in terms of people's memories. So what's the path forward? Here I want to bring us back to the 10 principles of conservatism that Russell Kirk put forth in The Politics of Prudence. First, the thinking conservative understands that permanence and change must be recognized and reconciled in a vigorous society. Too many so-called conservatives, including some in this room, believe that a diversifying America will necessarily be less culturally conservative. We heard Helen say that America will look like California in the future. It's ironic because she's making those remarks in Texas, which is also a majority-minority state, that is the most vigorous model for what America could be in the future, a diverse, young, economically free, low-tax, low-regulation place that people like me are moving to because it represents the future of America. So the idea that somehow we can't be a diverse country and also reflect the values of the Philadelphia Society is at least empirically mistaken. So I can only describe that view as ignorant, and also because it ignores the fact that Asian cultures in particular are far more culturally conservative than Western ones. The thing that actually distinguishes Western civilization from Eastern is that liberalism originated in the West. To the degree that cultural conservatives write off the black vote due to, say, the black illegitimacy rate, they ignore the direct role of white supremacists in destroying black families through slavery and segregation, which is ironic given that conservatives should, in theory, be most equipped to understand how historical circumstances and cultural inheritance affect the way we live today. And yet when it comes to civil rights, we say, well, we passed the Civil Rights of 1964, Act of 1964, everything's fine, there's nothing more that we need to do to address the challenges faced by black Americans. It's especially that ironic that we conservatives, we the alleged custodians of history and tradition, have gone out of our way not to confront our own opposition to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which goes far deeper than what we described this morning, a technical concern about public accommodations legislation. Movement conservatives, including Barry Goldwater, Bill Buckley, and Robert Bork, opposed nearly all legislative and judicial efforts to achieve civil rights. An entire chapter of The Conscience of a Conservative is devoted to decrying Brown v. Board of Education and proposed a constitutional amendment to restore the rights of states to segregate their schools. Bork wrote that public accommodations legislation represented, quote, a principle of unsurpassed ugliness in the New Republic, a statement that played no small part in his Supreme Court confirmation hearings. We talk endlessly about the Bill of Rights, but almost never about the amendments that came afterward, especially those of particular significance to black Americans. If we talk about the 14th Amendment, it's to complain about it, or to ignore or distort its plain statutory meaning. And while American conservatives are quick to wax poetic about the traditions of their own ancestors, we are all too frequently aggressively hostile to the desire of recent immigrants to honor the traditions of their ancestors and associate with others who share their cultural affinities. We criticize these things as identity politics, when the more accurate term is cultural conservatism. Somehow, for reasons I can't figure out, I've never read an essay in National Review or Modern Age decrying the Knights of Columbus or the Mayflower Society as agents of identity politics. We understand these institutions as constructive contributors to our traditions. Russell Kirk understood that conservatives uphold the principle of voluntary community, embrace the principle of variety, and celebrate custom, convention, and continuity. Immigrant communities epitomize these principles, but that's not how we as conservatives talk about it. Instead, we complain that immigrants don't abandon their ancestral customs quickly enough for our own tastes. Russell Kirk understood also the value of prudence and of prudent restraints upon power and upon human passions. And this is why I'm talking about this issue. It's not because I want to say diversity is our strength, blah, 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 be politically correct. I'm making a prudential argument about the future prospects of our movement. Too much of American cultural conservatism today is imprudent, both in rhetoric and policy, because restoring the America of 1955 would require us, at the very least, to repeal the development of birth control, constrain the role of women in the economy, and bar immigration from non-European countries. So if we can't do those things, if I've persuaded you that restoring the 1955 Ancien Régime is imprudent and even potentially radical, what should conservatives do? What can we do? Change is the means of our preservation. First, we have to forthrightly confront the unflattering aspects of our own civil rights history and our blind spots regarding our attitudes towards minorities and immigrants. Just as you can't ask forgiveness without acknowledging your sins, our failure to forthrightly acknowledge our mistakes on civil rights is directly responsible for our failure to fix affirmative action and secure the border and reform family-destroying welfare policies, because we get called racist instead of being publicly spirited. For those who are convinced this is impossible, look at the Conservative Party of Canada. Canadian conservatives have built a majority coalition by investing their time, resources, and most importantly, their friendships in immigrant communities. They listen. By doing so, they found that they've expanded their ability to advance economic freedom because they've built a coalition that is demographically durable and one that strives to unite all Canadians, regardless of where their ancestors came from, around enduring principles. Today, according to the Heritage Foundation, Canada outranks the United States in economic freedom. You can even look closer to home. Here in Texas, every seventh grader is required to take Texas history. And when you're required to take Texas history, you learn that Texas was once owned by Mexico. And then the Anglos came and created the Republic of Texas, and then Texas joined the United States. But the point of all that is to say that no Texan who's taken Texas history fails to understand that Latino culture is part of the fabric of Texas. And that simple understanding gives the relationship between Anglos and Latinos here a dignity and a mutual respect that it often doesn't have in other parts of the country. And that's why 45% of Hispanics vote Republican in every governor's election in Texas, and why America ought to look like Texas in the future, and why Texas can be a model for how a diverse country can be conservative in 2030 and 2040. Too many of us have concluded that the values of liberty and order can only be embraced by those of European descent. Classical conservatism understands that liberty and order are universal principles, and that, most importantly, they are aspirations found in people hailing from every corner of the world. Thank you.